Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Training Tidbits podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge from Animal Training Academy, and I'm extremely excited about having you here with us today and being back in your eardrums to talk all about best practice behavior management for what is set to be another amazing episode. I can't wait to dive in and learn all about today's guest and their learning odyssey. If you haven't checked the past episodes out yet, then make sure to head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and you can listen to them all there, or you can also find them on iTunes and/or on Stitcher. There is definitely something there for absolutely everyone, as well as some sensational up-and-coming episodes planned over the next wee while. Just before we do get started, though, I would like to take this opportunity to share some of the really exciting things happening with ATA, i.e. Animal Training Academy. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area. Some of the ingredients of the membership include forums with hundreds of training videos and projects, where together the community helps problem solve different training situations. We then have the private Facebook group where we share animal training successes, members updates, and relevant content from the web. On top of this, we have WhatsApp chat groups with separate group chats for horses, dogs, cats, birds, exotic animals, and more. Via these groups and direct from your smartphones, you can engage in text message-based conversations with an international community of positive reinforcement animal trainers. And then to top it all off, we connect live twice a month in members-only live web classes, where we dive even deeper into the topics you'll learn about here. To find out more about membership and how you can join the community and carry on the conversation, visit www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu. But we will get started on today's episode, where I'm going to be talking to Nikki Boyd. Nikki is the behavior husbandry manager at the San Diego Zoo. Her educational background includes graduating from Moorpark College's Exotic Animal Training and Management Program, Massey College's Animal Health Technician Program with an Associate in Science degree and a Bachelor's in Business Administration from the University of Phoenix. Nikki has worked at the San Diego Zoo for 25 years in various departments such as zookeeper at the Children's Zoo and Veterinarian Hospital, animal handler in the behavior department, senior keeper, team area lead, animal care supervisor, animal care manager, personal manager, and now currently as the behavior husbandry manager. Nikki is currently the president of the Red Panda Network, which is a non-profit organization dedicated to saving habitat for wild red pandas. And she is also the past president for the Animal Behavior Management Alliance, the ABMA. She also serves on the board of directors there and has done for 9 years. To build upon this, Nikki is also on the board of directors for the International Avian Certification Board, and she is a certified bird trainer. She serves on both the Animal Ambassador Species Advisory Group and the Behavior Advisory Group of AZA committees. Her role as Behavior Husbandry Manager is to set up training programs all over the San Diego Zoo. She works with various species of bears, large and small cats, hyenas, canids, animal ambassadors, and many species of other mammals, birds, and reptiles. Training dangerous animals means being in close proximity, and this requires focus, appropriate facilities, and good safety protocols. Part of Nikki's role is training staff to be safe whilst training animals. Without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Nikki Boyd to the show today. Nikki, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me, Ryan.
It's our absolute pleasure. And we're going to dive straight into the first question today, Nikki. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first started to learn about positive reinforcement animal training and some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Well, it's funny. I had lots of pets growing up. And I think when I really had to apply that positive reinforcement training was when my parents thought that they would be parrot breeders and decided to get 6 macaws. I was in elementary school at the time and ended up working very closely with one of my favorites was one of the scarlet macaws. And so teaching him, you know, basic behaviors, stepping up, mimicking, things like that. I remember doing my science fair project, which here in the States we do and all the 6th graders get to do on food preferences for macaws because I had all these birds in my house and I thought I've got to do something with these birds. Those are some of my fond memories growing up and certainly what probably led me into my career of animal management. Not only did I work with the parrots, but my grandfather had horses. And so I would go visit his ranch and he would give me opportunities to feed the horses and everything. And he told me, this horse is yours. And so I was grooming this horse and I would feed it carrots. And of course, I was a child, so I named it Bunny. And one day I decided that I wanted to ride the horse and I decided I would just jump on its back and hold on to its mane and ride it around the corral. And apparently my relationship was strong enough. So the horse let me climb on its back from the pipe corral and ride it around. And my grandmother at the time saw me riding this horse that had never apparently been ridden before. And she came running over screaming like, what are you doing? Get off the horse. She was afraid I was going to get hurt. And of course I'm pulling on the mane like reins, asking it to stop. And it wasn't stopping because it didn't really know those cues and commands yet. It gently took me back to the side of the corral where I promptly jumped onto the pipe corral and jumped off the horse. But I think she just about had a heart attack. Luckily I had built a strong enough relationship with the horse. It didn't buck me off and it trusted me enough to ride it around the corral. I'll never forget that story. And I don't think she will either.
And what do you think led to that relationship that you already had with that horse? And what was, thinking back to that time now, what kind of lessons did you learn at that point, do you think?
You know, I think a lot of people say, you know, I'm an animal person, but there are true connections you have with animals. And of course, feeding it carrots and grooming it and a gentle touch and building that trust and spending time with that animal built that relationship of trust between us. I was probably too naive to realize the danger I was in, and I trusted the horse, and the horse had a strong enough affinity for me that even though it was the first time being ridden, it trusted me enough not to hurt it as well. And so I think while learning the danger after and probably ruined some of the naivety I had about all animals love me, I realized that there is danger, but that if you did have the time and the patience to build a relationship with an animal, that you could communicate with that animal and have a relationship, which I did use with those parrots and, of course, all the dogs and cats and animals that I had over the years before going off to college. I think that relationship is a huge part of animal training, and it's come back to me time and time again when we haven't been able to get behavior here at the San Diego Zoo, or how do you build that veterinary relationship with the animal? And so relationship, I think, is one of those key factors I learned as a young child.
Carrots, food, and trust. And the challenge, you articulated it as the potential naivety as a young human learner of, with regards to your safety. And that's quite cool that you're in the position you are now. So maybe it all started back then.
I think so.
So wonderful. And I love hearing and learning about people's behavior odyssey. So thank you very much for sharing that, Nikki.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could now please bring us up to speed and share with us some information about your current role and about animal training at the San Diego Zoo.
Yes, of course. I always say I have the best job in the zoo. Not only do I get to set up the zoo-wide animal training program, but I also manage all of the animal ambassadors. And it's kind of a nice collaboration because I can have consistency. Sometimes ambassadors are managed one way and the other zoo animals are managed another way. And so I can bring those teams together and we all learn from each other. And it's really all goes back to watching behavior, building the relationship, using positive reinforcement. And as you alluded to in the description of my job, a big passion of mine is safety. And so I do a lot of talks on safety with training, working safely around dangerous animals, all the considerations that go into that as we are closer to our animals, especially, you know, some of the protected contact species that we have to consider all the potentials. These are still wild animals and we respect that fact. But when you're desensitizing or counterconditioning an animal to an injection, you're never going to stop that needle poke from hurting, but you can certainly make it worth their while through positive reinforcement. And I've been very pleased at the progress and the momentum shift. As you mentioned, I've been here 25 years. So when I first started, I came with a training background from Moorpark. And I also, as you mentioned, went through the veterinary technician program. And so I married those two skill sets that I came to the San Diego Zoo with to train animals to participate in medical husbandry behaviors. And that's, I think, what, as a keeper, as I was doing more and more of injection training and blood draw training and getting my animals comfortable with things like injections, the veterinary staff had confidence in me to be able to give an injection or to know how to handle needles. Then they also had the confidence that I had a background in understanding operant conditioning and behavior modification. And so I started to get asked to go out into the zoo and do different training programs. And that led to my role as the behavior husbandry manager. I've been doing this for about 7 years now.
So I think we're going to name the title of this podcast, I Have the Best Job in the Zoo.
I think that would be very appropriate. I've said that many times, and I get to work with so many different species. I really feel blessed, and I get to go all over zoo grounds and watch our amazing animal care staff do training programs. We've recently got sharks in our facility, and so going down to the shark habitat and helping the shark keeper be able to target train sharks and building targets for her. I get to constantly work with new species and learn. That's what I love about my job, is I'm always learning. And later, as we talk about ABMA and stuff, we'll talk about the opportunities for professional development. But we have almost 4,000 animals here at the zoo. So of course, all of them aren't trained, but most of them, the higher vertebrates, do have training programs. And so getting to work with so many different species and seeing what makes them tick and what's motivating for them has really been a joy for me.
And can you explain for those listening who might not be familiar, what do you mean when you say animal ambassador?
So animals that do different types of educational programs. So a lot of our programs are on zoo grounds where we bring animals out for shows. We might do walk-arounds, educational programs. We have a lot of camps. We go offsite to schools and children's hospitals and even nursing homes where people maybe can't come to the zoo. And so we take the animals to them. So animal ambassadors are trained to be show animals in a way where they go out and they actually can help do the different programs. And you can really capture people's attention. There is a lot of documentation that shows animal ambassadors really help solidify that conservation message. And they help connect people to wildlife and get that empathy and that caring. And so, as you mentioned, I worked in the children's zoo for many years. We have an entire animal ambassador collection in our children's zoo, but we also have different areas like our Wegaforth Bull Show can seat up to 1,500 people. And so that's a big dynamic production show. We have premium tours where you might have a smaller intimate show where you pay a special fee and you get an hour-long program at our Animals in Action show. And you get to meet things like cheetah or clouded leopard or rhino or flamingo up close. And even though rhinos don't come out and go off to do programs, of course, they're still considered an ambassador. Even our giraffe feeding is considered an ambassador by the AZA model of what an animal ambassador is. People are interacting with the animal. Maybe they get to feed or touch. But most of the ambassadors that we manage in my collection get to come out and do different programs, whether it's on or off site.
Very cool. And I just want to touch on one thing before we move on to the next question. A lot of the people that listen to the podcast work in zoological organizations, and a lot of people are just working with their domestic animals at home.
Uh-huh.
And what I really like from engaging with this diverse group of people is the massive uptake nowadays in medical training with dogs and cats and our pets at home. If you were to offer one tip for people listening at home that want to engage in this type of training with their pets, what little tidbit could you give those listening?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's actually a passion of mine and many of my animal trainers as well. In our Animals in Action show, we actually have dogs that are cheetah companions. We show dog training and we talk about the opportunity to train with positive reinforcement. And a lot of times people are telling their animals what not to do. And so using no and using, you know, punishment and negative reinforcement with leashes. So we talk to them in the beginning of the show and they're going to be with us for an hour. So we have lots of training terminology and they get to learn like the application of positive reinforcement. And then we demonstrate it and we talk about choice and control too. And we talk about teaching your animal what to do to earn reinforcement and incompatible behaviors as well. So we teach a lot of behaviors with our dog and cheetah ambassadors to heal, to follow, to do A to Bs, to sit for duration of time. And then we give them the opportunity to earn reinforcement that whole time. And so then it's not just put a collar and a leash on and let them feel the restraint of the leash, but teaching them to heal teaches them to walk by our side. So they already have the understanding that I'm supposed to walk by your side and we don't have to train our animals through negative reinforcement. So they run to the end of the leash, feel the pressure, and then they release the pressure to reinforce themselves. So I think if people can work teaching their animals what to do instead of what not to do, it really helps the bond, that relationship, the trust. And it makes that healthier pet. So if you're out at a dog park and training a good recall, so if an animal comes back for a whistle, it takes a long time and then you punish it for coming back, you're going to decrease the likeliness it's going to come back the next time. So even if it takes a little bit of time, reinforce that and you'll see that quicker response. And you can use your different reinforcers for animals. It can be food, it can be tactile, especially with domestic animals. Tactile works really well for dogs. Setting our animals up for success. That's kind of what our motto is and what we teach people to hopefully take home and apply to their domestic animals as well.
Cool. And that's exciting. People coming in, seeing the work you guys are doing and hopefully taking it home with them. And then that just continues on as their friends and family hopefully see what they get up to as well.
Right.
So thank you so much for sharing that. It was a lot of fun to learn about. For our next question, Nikki, I wanted to discuss weight management and how this influences our training. Now, this is quite a big conversation. So potentially we can start with talking about the importance of weigh routines with our animals and target weight.
Sure. If you work with birds, weight management is part of your routine, and it's usually with the free flight bird programs. Food is a powerful reinforcer, but it can be mismanaged. And so this talk on weight management that I gave at ABMA and a variety of conferences, I really wanted to kind of get people thinking differently about weight management. One, we want our animals to be healthy. So having good target weights is important. And we're going to talk a little bit more probably about behavior as a study of one. Well, body size, you can't have one weight works best for all animals. So you need to think of it on an individual basis. You want to look at the health of your animal, not just by the weight, but there's a variety of body scoring charts out there that you can utilize. Everything from tortoises to bears, camels, dogs, cats. And I think we're going to make those available. Is that correct, Ryan? We're going to offer files. Yeah. So you can look at your animal and have some objective information to know if the animal is healthy or not. And certainly you have to look at age, if they're young, are they growing? Are they an adult? Are they geriatric? And consider the body condition scoring for all of those different life cycles that they'll go through. But food is often the primary reinforcer for a lot of animals. And so my goal in the zoo industry was to get people thinking about weight management from a health perspective. And if you're not getting behavior, or you're not getting cooperation in your training program, don't just rely on the food resource, but look at the animal holistically. So could there be a medical issue? Could there be a dental issue? We had a serval as an example that wasn't eating really well. And so it was a little overweight with looking at the body. We thought, well, he's a little heavy. Maybe we should cut back some of the food. Maybe he's just not food motivated. But the keepers were watching him eat and he was chewing a little funny on one side. And so he had a medical exam by our veterinarians and he had some retained deciduous or baby teeth and they were causing him pain probably in his mouth. And that was why he wasn't eating. It wasn't that he didn't want to participate in the training. But had we just relied on reducing food intake to get him at a lower weight, then we would have totally missed that opportunity to look for that medical issue. So that's just one example of reasons why you don't want to just rely on food to get motivation, but also you want your animal to be healthy throughout its lifetime. I know a lot of us feel bad with our domestic animals at home or even some of the zoo animals when they're begging for food or they seem hungry, and you actually create a worse problem when you let them get obese because one, then when you do have to bring the diet down, you cause frustration and sometimes aggression, but you also can cause arthritis and other medical issues. A lot of animals will have difficulty giving birth or dystocia if they're overweight. And so kind of reminding people, look at your animal in a holistic way. You're going to benefit your animal. You're going to benefit your relationship with that animal long term. But there's so many other considerations too. There may be temperature changes. So we train a lot of our reptiles here. You know, how are they working in the winter versus the summer? Some animals go into hibernation states. So we have to change our management program with our grizzly bears in the winter. In San Diego, the weather's pretty nice year round. Average is 70 degrees. You wouldn't know that today because it's about 90 degrees Fahrenheit, but normally we have a very mild temperature. And so even though the animals don't have a full snow environment, they still have natural history of hibernation. And so we see them reducing their food intake. We also see them wanting to bulk up in the fall. So we have to know the natural history of so many different species and apply our training and food management appropriately. So we're lucky here. We have full-time nutritionists, two of them with PhDs. And so they know exactly the nutritional and caloric intake and what is the most healthy, nutritionally balanced diet. And they work with us to adjust accordingly. And they also give us a point system, which allows us to have enrichment points that aren't just for enrichment, but you can be used for training as well, where you modify whatever reinforcers, because reinforcers can lose value over time too. So you have to know your animal. And if you know, they always enjoy peanut butter and today they're just really not taking the peanut butter. They maybe they want some fish or they want some meat or peanuts or something different. And so we have some flexibility in our diet management to change up our reinforcers. And we're pretty good at being proactive about it. So nothing gets really boring. We kind of mix it up. We also know some guidelines to stay within the calorie content so that we're not constantly overfeeding to give extra reinforcers for training and causing obesity or any of those other medical problems I mentioned.
So weight management from a health perspective, and you mentioned the importance of that circle of observation. You also mentioned that earlier, the importance of observation when discussing your role at San Diego Zoo. Can you talk to this with regards to training in general and to weight management? That's the importance of just spending more time
observing animals. So observation skills are really important, and that's what you will find with a lot of people who are really good with animals. Wild animals will mask any kind of illness or weakness. It's a natural survival instinct, so prevent predation in the wild, or if you're in a social hierarchy with primates or different hoofstock, which are prey items, will mask illness. And so keepers have to pick up on a very subtle difference in an animal. And so part of the weight management is looking, again, holistically. So if an animal stops eating, is it satiated? Is it hormonal? Is it want to breed? Is it time for it to go into hibernation? Is there a dental issue? I love training a nice mouth open behavior for a lot of our animals because that's a really quick indicator if there's a tooth issue. You'll have carnivores that can break off a canine tooth. And if you can get a nice mouth open, the veterinarians can come look in the mouth, say, oh, yep, we need to do a dental exam. Or no, the teeth look great. So we can rule out that it's a tooth issue. It also gives you a look at the tongue or if there's anything else going on with the mouth. So my goal for teaching all the keepers here and presenting this weight management discussion is please look at your animal. With birds, there used to be a theory that for free flight birds, when you started off a free flight program, you just dropped the weight 10% right off the bat. And we're learning more and more, as you heard, I'm a certified avian trainer, is that birds will fly at an ad lib weight. It's not about just the food motivation. It's about the relationship. It's about setting up your antecedent arrangements so that those birds are set up for success. And that's the same for observing any species of animal, is looking at your antecedent arrangement, predicting if something might frighten that animal or set them up to not be successful. If the crate door is always slamming on them, you know, can you prop the door open? There's different ways to mitigate your arrangements so that you can set your animal up for success in whatever training program you're doing. Noticing those subtle changes, they start to increase in weight. You know, we regularly weigh our animals. We set up our facilities to have scales for animals as they shift in and out. And having a scale, whether you're at home with your pets or you're at a zoo or aquarium, thinking of one of our first training behaviors is getting weights on animals. We weigh our animals regularly. And so having that baseline data and being able to compare with other animals that are of similar species, are you trending in an appropriate manner? Are the animals' growth rates appropriate, or are they growing too fast? That can cause bone issues. Are they growing too slow, which can also cause medical issues? So observing your animals and weighing them regularly, all those data points are going to help you be a better animal care person overall.
I like that. And can you just talk a little bit more to this, the importance of weigh routines? You just discussed it and you briefly mentioned there that you actually work quite hard to set up the facilities in ways where this sets both you and the animal up for success. Can you give us some more examples of how you do this?
Yeah, it starts very early on in the architectural process. And we've been very, I think, smart and forward thinking to include the keepers in the early design process. And we've actually created some matrix here at the San Diego Zoo, which will allow us to use these models for future habitat designs. So we like to build in chutes where the animals will regularly go through on a routine basis, which sets up a routine to build confidence. So, you know, when you're consistently walking through a chute, you get lots of reinforcement, you go out onto your habitat and you come back in through the chute, you know, we stop the animals in the chute and it might have a transport crate in there. It might have a squeeze, which is like a panel may squeeze in so you can work on injection training. It might have a scale in there. And so for every new habitat we build, we try to build in these chutes that have scales. They have transport crates. So you can, if you need to relocate them to a new habitat or they need to go up for their annual exam or any other of those reasons, we build these, you know, routine transport crates so that they walk through them almost every day. And it gives that animal this confidence that, oh, I'm going into the crate. And it makes it easier for us too, because if the keepers have to run them through there every day, then we're not hauling a crate in. And now we have to habituate them or desensitize them to a new crate in the area. Some of the older facilities, you'd bring a crate in and maybe they had some negative history with it where it's, oh, last time a crate got brought in, I went to the veterinarian. And so that crate has a negative connotation. And that can be applied to domestic animals as well. So we use crates and reinforce crates all the time. And when you can build them into the habitats where it's, you don't have to move a bunch of stuff and it's really easy, it certainly makes managing the collection a lot easier.
Yeah. And as the architects of our own homes and our
own
it's right. Something we can definitely do to set our pets up for success, isn't it?
Right. Yes. It's, you know, as they get older, I have dachshunds at home, so they have long backs that are prone to back issues. So, you know, making sure I have steps available to them, how you feed your animals, it can change as they age as well. But we have a lot of considerations for that with geriatric animals. We have a lot of quality of life programs that we consider as the animals get older. How are they going to move around? What do they need if they do have arthritis? We have been able to medicate and train for that. We consider where they're sleeping and how they get in and out of that sleeping habitat. If it's cold outside, you know, arthritis gets aggravated with the cold. So what heat can we provide or what bedding can we provide for them to kind of snuggle up in? So all of those considerations, I think, make animal care professionals more set up for success, because when the animal is comfortable and happy and healthy, then as a training program, you're going to be more successful. And some of those considerations, like we were shifting our Tawkins, which are a large kind of musk ox type of hoofstock. And when it was really cold, they're a little more arthritic. They're built for the cold, but their lifespans are a lot longer in managed care. So we made these considerations, and you have windows of opportunity where you give an animal an opportunity to respond to a cue. And we certainly knew in the winter, we would give the Tawkins a little longer window of opportunity to shift over to get their favorite reinforcement so the keeper could clean the other side of the habitat. But you have to look at managing your animals holistically with weight management and with all of those other considerations that I just mentioned.
Great information. Mm-hmm. And I know there's loads of people who listen to the show for whom this is going to be highly beneficial. So thank you very much for sharing all of that, Nikki.
You're welcome.
In this part, I was wondering if we could please now discuss your role, or your past role, I should say, as president of the ABMA for the past 3 years.
Yeah. ABMA stands for the Animal Behavior Management Alliance, and it's an international organization, but it's most of our constituents are here in the United States, but we do some international conferences as well. And it's a great opportunity for professional development. We do a conference once a year, and then we have quarterly newsletters. And we also have information on our website that can be used for professional development. So even if you're not in the United States, you can still be a member. We actually have about 26 different countries that represent our membership. The ABMA is connected with the San Diego Zoo Global Academy, and so it gives a lot of opportunity for different courses available online. We pay for that service for all of our members. And the conferences, I just always find really inspiring. Next year, we're going to be in San Antonio, and most of the talks are on training, and it's training for every different species, but I find every talk engaging. If somebody's training a fish, I think, okay, if they can train that fish, I can train my snow leopard to do this. Or I've seen eel training. I've seen amazing advancements in animal welfare through going to these conferences and seeing the dedication from the animal care staff at all of the new advancing techniques on everything from injection training to ultrasound to x-ray to hoof management on a hoofstock. How do you train an okapi to let you trim its hooves? And so I go there and I send as many as my staff as I can. And we try to rotate it each year. We offer professional development for our staff to go. But we also don't just focus on zoos and aquariums. There are rescue dog training, service animal training, pet parrot, companion parrot discussions, horse training. And so it's very well-rounded. We try to get laboratory input from different laboratory training scenarios. And I think just the overall goal for ABMA is to continue the advancement of training and enrichment. And we hope to inspire people to look at it in a different light, maybe get some new ideas to go back and try with their animals. We always have a great response and we get lots of motivation. So it's not just about training, it's also about enrichment. So when you're looking at your behavioral management program, you may spend a certain amount of your day training, but we have this 24/7 model. What is your animal doing when you're not there? It has a relationship with its environment too. This can, again, go from zoo animals to companion animals, occupying its time, enriching its life, enriching its habitats, wherever it's at, challenging it. You know, animals are very smart at problem solving, and every different species has its different level of what it's good at because they are built for whatever they need to be doing, whether it's a hoofstock, a reptile, a fish, a carnivore, a primate. And so you should model your training and enrichment to challenge those animals and to constantly stimulate their minds. We're getting more and more intelligent studies out there of what they can actually learn. And I know here at the San Diego Zoo and at ABMA, you'll see talks on research projects. So we're adding evidence-based science behind a lot of this new welfare and choice and control enhancements.
26 different countries and no copy training. I thought it'd be really neat as well to talk about some of the awards and grants that the ABMA provides. Can you speak to this?
Yeah. So at the end of the conference, we let all of the attendees vote on different awards. There's impact awards, so something that made a big impact into the environment. We have a conservation award. So we have members of ABMA who go to different countries, often, you know, third world countries that maybe don't have a lot of resources for training. We recently gave out a couple of awards. There's Gerardo Martinez was going to teach mahouts in India how to train elephants with positive reinforcement. And that's a long historical ingrained tradition that you are the boss, you dominate your animal. And the mahouts are learning so much more about positive reinforcement training and how to manage foot care safely and how to manage their animals with positive reinforcement. It's really increasing the safety of their interactions with elephants over there. And another woman, Barbara Glatz, has gone down to Africa and taught a lot of the police about horse and dog training with their police animals. She's shown a lot of videos of how they used to, you know, jump on the horse and kick it and kick it and kick it. And the horse didn't really want to do what it was supposed to do because it really wasn't motivated. What's in it for the animals? So she went down and she goes down regularly and, you know, basically has no real budget or funding. She gets a little bit of support, but we were hoping to help her with that and publicize some of her work. But she showed them how you can train the horse and the dogs and have a better response for whether the dogs are sniffing for illegal contraband, bushmeat, everything from ivory to pangolin. And teaching those dogs positive reinforcement training and having that relationship with their trainers versus, you know, being punished for any behavior that they didn't do correctly. And they're seeing a lot more success in getting the correct behaviors from those dogs and that relationship with the horses, where the horses are just gently guided to take the police through whatever trails they need to do versus having to constantly be either kicked or, you know, some of the people were scared of the horses because the horses were aggressive and they would bite at them or kick at them. So now the relationship is completely changed. So ABMA likes to support people who are going out there in the field and making a difference with positive reinforcement training. You go to the conference and you present, you could win everything from a welfare enhancement award. All of the different awards are listed on our website at theabma.org. So you can definitely go on there and see all the different opportunities and some of the past award winners as well.
Fantastic. And the work Barbara is doing sounds amazing. Definitely keen to learn more about that. Sadly, we are now nearly at the end, but that's okay. Because we're also heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show, and this is story time. Nikki, can you please share with everyone listening two or three stories from your experience working and training animals so far and some of the important lessons that these have taught you along the way?
Sure. I picked out a couple different stories. One of the first ones that for me was a huge success story in my career, I felt, was we had some river hippos here at the San Diego Zoo that we were trying to introduce for breeding. We had had success in the past, but it was time to get new genetics going. So we brought in a new male, and boy, our female just did not like him at all. And she was a little bit larger than him. So she was using her tusks to chase him off, and she'd hurt him quite a bit. And so the veterinarian said, can you trim those tusks down so she can't use that as a weapon? And I thought, okay, yeah, let's try this. I have three children, so taking them to the dentist and explaining to them that they need to go is a chore in itself. But to have a hippo voluntarily allow you to trim her teeth down was a big learning experience for me. So we found what was motivating for her. A mouth open behavior is pretty easy with the hippo because you just show them a piece of watermelon or something and they open their mouth right away. And so she already had an established mouth open behavior. It was getting her to allow us to trim those tusks down with some giggly wire. And we were successful and we had our challenges along the way, but we were able to trim her tusks and we put the male and female back together. They bred within like 15 minutes. partially because we tried to time it, of course, with the hormone cycle. And I think they had been around each other, but hadn't had full contact for the many months it took us to actually train these tusks off. But they've had several babies since then. And so we certainly don't need to keep trimming them, but to finally get the tips of those tusks and hold them in your hand and say, okay, we actually trained a hippo to basically go to the dentist and allow us to manipulate her teeth was quite a success story. The other story I was thinking of, something we've just done recently, and I mentioned it earlier on, but it's really a new way of thinking with training cheetah ambassadors. And we're actually pairing this with a research project where we're looking at behavior and collecting fecals for cortisol levels. And we're looking at the welfare of cheetah ambassadors. And what we used to do in the past was we would train them early on to just be desensitized to a collar. And, you know, you start attaching the leash and they learn pretty quickly that there's some restraint there. And so that they would walk along with you. But it was a lot of negative reinforcement. So as soon as they pulled and felt the collar on their neck, they would slow down and release that pressure themselves, thus reinforcing themselves. So we didn't even try leash and collar for the longest time. We trained a lay down with duration. So they must lay in a position, which will help us in the long run with body exams or blood draws. We trained a sit and just stay on the rock and wait for your next cue. We trained A to B. So we're getting them to run across this big habitat that they have. So they get their exercise, but it's from one trainer to the next. So they learn to come and target to that trainer. So it makes a great recall. We don't work them off leash outside of the habitat, but it's certainly fun for the guests to see. And we trained that heel behavior where they walked beside us. And so now when we walk them, they've since been trained with the collar and the leash. The leash is slack. The animal stands right next to the trainer, walks slowly along, is not pulling. We let them look around and explore the different environments around the zoo habitat. And we certainly can take them off zoo grounds. But we've completely thrown out the old model of how we've trained our cheetah ambassadors and started this new model. And I couldn't be prouder of my team for the success they've had. And I hope to present it. AZA conference starts next Friday. And so I'm going to be showing some of these training successes that we've had. And the last story I had was looking at, as you mentioned earlier, that I manage a lot of the animal ambassadors. And animal ambassadors, most of the time, were either rejected from their mom or in a rehab facility that couldn't be released into the wild. And we're finding that we can have mother-reared ambassadors where the mother gets to nurse them and suckle them, and we can separate a mother. I was going to use our serval as an example. So we have a habitat here at the San Diego Zoo with serval, and she had a couple of babies. And so we were able to give mom her favorite treats in the bedroom next door and shift her over and then start working with these baby servals as early as like 12 days old. In the beginning, it was just a couple of minutes and then let mom come back. And they were still nursing, so we basically used toys to be reinforcing. But eventually, as they weaned and they got older and they started using food reinforcement and it was time for them to move away from mom, we were able to just keep that relationship strong. And now they're working as animal ambassadors in some of our show areas. And instead of being taken to a nursery where they're bottle fed and having that human relationship, now we're having them have a relationship as a serval with a relationship with humans. But to take it full circle, these animals are also potentially going to be breeding in the future. So they can be, hopefully by being raised by their mothers, they will be better parents in the future and have that kind of the wild animal instinct. So it's kind of this nice balance and a new model for animal ambassadors.
Yeah, very neat. Training 12-day-old servals, loose leash walking cheetahs. And here is the second contender for the title of the podcast. How do you explain to a hippo to go to the dentist? And
yes,
for all those young adults listening, hey, if you go to the dentist, if you take away a lesson from Nikki's story, you might get some action, right?
Yeah, I need to teach my dentist how to reinforce my kids for going to the dentist. They used to give out lollipops, but that's counterintuitive to being a dentist, I guess. I guess the new toothbrush is their reinforcer, but it doesn't always work.
So great. And what fantastic lesson. Sadly, though, this does bring us now to the final question for this episode, Nikki. Could you please take us all into the future now and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world?
Well, I've kind of mentioned some of our recent advancements in animal management, and I just went through an amazing welfare course. The last 2 days we've spent here at the San Diego Zoo in animal welfare. And so I've got some new goals for myself with getting that evidence, collecting that evidence-based information to look at your animals, their habitats, and thinking of their feeding strategies. So again, a lot of animals that are being trained, you hold back some of their favorite food for training. And so there's this, you know, anticipatory, oh, I'm going to get trained now and I'm waiting for my keeper. To how do you save some of that food and enrich that habitat so that they are able to express species-specific, relatively adaptive behaviors in that habitat? The guests really appreciate it. So we're doing more carcass feeding. We're doing enrichment devices where food gets released at random times. There's so many advances out there. So I think in the next 10 years, you're going to see welfare enhancements improve. You're going to see exhibit design improve. You're going to see animals that have a more holistic approach throughout their day. If they're nocturnal, maybe their feeders are going off at night versus our human schedule of daytime. You're going to see a lot of training advancements. I mean, we're doing so many things, like we're comparing polar bear energetics here at the San Diego Zoo with helping wild researchers figure out how climate change is affecting polar bears in the wild. So I'm involved in a lot of research projects that help our wild counterparts. And, you know, the whole world is managed care now. And so I think zoos have that really important role in collaborating with wild researchers, mitigating human-animal conflict, and educating the public on our mission here at the San Diego Zoo is ending extinction. I mean, it's a lofty goal, but we are dedicated to it. And I think if we all kind of look at those welfare advancements, we can apply those to wild animals and inspire people to want to save habitat and get more involved with conservation of animals.
That's a great vision. And we are, of course, all working really hard to help make these things transpire as we move forward over the coming years. As mentioned, that does bring us to the end. But before we wrap up, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, Buffalo Herds of Animal Training Academy, gratitude to you for making time to come on the show today. Thank you very much, Nikki.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ryan. Love your show.
Oh, thank you very much.
If you have enjoyed this episode today and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about the most positive and less intrusive ways of influencing behavior, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with like-minded, positive reinforcement-based animal trainers from around the world. Whether you train or are thinking about training dogs, cats, other pets, birds, zoo animals, implementing techniques within your vet clinic, or any other area where behavior management is required, then you will love all the different ways you can join in, whether it be the forums, WhatsApp chats, the private Facebook group, or in one of the members-only live web classes. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we are looking forward to having you join the family. That's it for this episode, though. We will wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. Take it easy. And if it ain't easy, take it twice. And you'll hear from us again soon.